Welcome to episode 36 of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. And a quick reminder for everyone, 40 Minutes in the Old Testament and everything that we do is listener-supported stuff. So if you would like to support it, you can go over to ChristWillFast.org and go on the support page, and you can make a one-time gift. You can make a reoccurring gift of any amount, your choice. And that would help us. And thank you so much to those who have done that. Chad, where are we at in the Genesis narrative?
We're going to talk about food today. Are you hungry?
I am actually hungry. I haven't eaten yet.
Well, we'll whet your appetite with a tale of some tasty lentil soup. How's that sound?
Fantastic.
All right, good deal. We are we're in chapter 25, beginning at verse 27. Last time we got to the birth of twins, Jacob and Esau, and we heard that Rebekah was given a prophecy about the older serving the younger. And when they were born, the younger was trying to get ahead of the older one. It says that when they came out, when the babies were born, that Esau was born first, but he came out with Jacob hanging on to his heel. Jacob was trying to pull his brother back into the womb so that he could get ahead of him and be the firstborn. So even from their infancy, even from the day of their birth, Jacob is trying to usurp the position that Esau has. And you know, as far as all the arguments about nature and nurture, at least in this case, it's all nature for Jacob. He's a usurper. He's trying to get ahead. Anything he can do, even if later he has to resort to lying and deception and all sorts of trickery to get ahead, that's what he's going to do. So that was their birthday, and so we're going to pick up here with verse 27 when they're all grown up, and as it turns out, nothing has changed. Jacob is still trying to get ahead of Esau. So here's how it starts. Chapter 25, verse 27 says, when the boys grew up. So we're going to leapfrog ahead here from their birthday all the way to when they're presumably grown men. You know, I don't know. This is 20, 30, 40 years. We really don't know. But they're adults now, and we're briefly given a description of what kind of people they are. So Esau is a hunter. He's a skillful hunter. He's a man of the field, it says. And Jacob is a peaceful or a mild man living in tents. Now, that little tidbit is something the Bible does very often. It will it'll give us a brief description of somebody that it's kind of dropped, but then it becomes significant later on. And that part about him being a hunter and Jacob being a man that lives in tents, that's going to become significant, especially in a couple chapters down the road. And we're also given another detail that is equally significant as the story unfolds, and that is that we have a divided loyalty between mom and dad. It says Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So we got the dad favoring the older son. We've got the mom favoring the younger son, and we're going to see how that all plays out when Isaac is old and it's time to give the blessing to the firstborn, and how Rebekah is conniving with her favorite son to get that blessing from the older one. So we're given those two details about them, what kind of lifestyle they lead, and which parent they are the favorite of. And then we have the first story about the interaction between these brothers. And as we'll see, it's bad from the start. So here's what happens. Jacob is at home. He's cooking. So we're here to the food part. He's cooking stew. It's a lentil soup. And Esau has been out hunting. He comes in from the field, and it says he's famished. So Esau says to his brother Jacob, please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished. Therefore, his name was called Edom, which means red. Now, put yourself in this situation. All right, your brother comes in from the field. You've been cooking. You've got plenty of food for him and for you and for everybody else. And your brother says, "Hey, I'm starving to death. I'm famished. I'm weary. So give me some of that food that you're cooking there." What are you going to say?
I would think I would probably give it to him.
I think that would be probably a fraternal thing to do, right? Somebody gets home, they're hungry, you know, they're not just hungry, but they're starving, they're famished. So you say, "Well, hey, you know, here's a big bowl. Fill it up, take as much as you want."
I was thinking something along the lines of, you know, "Am I my brother's keeper?"
Ah, yeah. So is Jacob his brother's keeper?
I guess the answer would be yes.
Yeah, I guess the answer would be yes.
A little bit of a parallel here with Abel.
Yeah, it is.
Cain and Abel.
You know, the fighting that takes place between brothers that we see beginning there with Cain and Abel and continuing here with Jacob and Esau, that's a pretty constant theme throughout the scriptures. You know, it even becomes, I don't think we've talked about this, but in the book of Galatians, when Paul wants to use an example of the division between those who are still in captivity to the law and those who are in the freedom of the gospel, he uses the example of two brothers, not full brothers, but brothers nonetheless, Isaac and Ishmael. So this idea of conflict between brothers is not only a common narrative that you see throughout the Old Testament, but really becomes thematic for two different kinds of people, two different kinds of nations in Paul's example in Galatians. Those who are of the law, those who are not of the promise, those are Ishmael, and those who are of the promise and freedom and liberation of the gospel, that's what Isaac stands for. So two brothers, conflict between them is a pretty big theme in the scriptures, starting in Genesis 4, then going all the way to the end.
I just want to say that the entire time I was growing up, I heard, yeah, he traded his birthright for a bowl of lentils, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I don't know if you've ever had, you know, lentils or seen lentils, but they're like these little
bean-type things, yeah.
Yeah, something. Yeah. And it was always talked about like they were just the worst or something, you know? And it's like trading.
To make the story even worse, yeah. He traded not for something real, like for a juicy steak for lentils.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So it was they talked about it like it was like a bowl of like Quaker oatmeal or something, right? But just recently, a guy at my church invited me over, and he was going to create his favorite peasant food dish.
Peasant food.
And
he has this cool
kind of obsession with peasant food, like with what regular people eat in different cultures. What do the regular people eat?
Yeah.
And he's convinced that it's like the best stuff because like they figure out how to do it in ways that make it amazing. And so one of the things that he made, the thing that he made when I went over there was he made lentils. And he seasoned them just right, and he put some other stuff in there with it, and it was actually amazing. It was really, really good. So now in my mind, ever since then, it's now turned, and when I think of like lentils, I'm like, well, lentils are pretty great. It's at the very least, I mean, it implies that Jacob knows how to cook, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's a culinary chef, at least of soup.
I mean, like his mom likes him because he's kind of a domesticated dude, right? And Esau's more of a hunter gatherer type, but I assume Jacob knows how to cook some food apparently. So yeah, I'm thinking it was those kind of lentils that are like that are at least good.
Yeah, at least if they're going to sell his birthright for it, it's going to be an extremely tasty meal.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, still not a good deal, but at least in my mind, it's not gross anymore. It's not like I'm dying. Give me that disgusting food you're making.
It's funny how when we know these stories, especially from our younger years, Sunday school and whatnot, you know, I think early on we fashion these ideas in our head about really what it's about, or, you know, we come in with all these assumptions like little soup is bad. And sometimes we never stop to question that.
Yeah.
Until we get a good meal made out of little soup. That's
I do think that Jacob is, I think, you know, putting yourself in the shoes of Jacob and trying to think like Jacob, trying to think like a sinner. I do think that he's got this easily justified in his mind. Cause I think that he's thinking, well, I mean, this guy's going to die. And if he dies, his birthright is mine. So it's a very merciful thing if I keep him alive. And then I have the right to, I should still get the birthright though. I mean, I'm going to get it either way. So really it's an act of mercy that I give you anything, because I don't have to give you soup for your birthright. I could just have you die and then I'll take your birthright. I'm pretty righteous in this whole deal here.
Yeah. I was thinking when you were talking of what we've discussed before, way back in Genesis chapter 3, this quote from Luther, that sin never wants to be sin. It always wants to be righteousness.
Yeah.
And what he means by that is basically we will find any way possible to justify our sin. Yeah. I see that in my own life all the time, kind of this inner justification that takes place. You know, where I think it's rare that we say to ourselves, this is wrong. This is sin. I'm going to do it anyway.
I've done it, but
I think it's rare. I think most of the time we are somewhat held back. And so what we'll do is almost instantaneously at times, and other times it takes longer, but we will go through this inner process of justification.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the very least, we believe a lie.
Yeah. At the very least, we will believe a lie. But that's the way that we soothe our conscience. That's the way that we make ourselves feel better about what either we have done or what we're about to do. This self-deception is probably our most practiced art as sinners.
Nobody believes you like you.
Nobody believes you like you. Exactly. We are able to convince ourselves of just about the justification of just about anything, given enough time to kind of think it through and reason it through and dream up all sorts of justifications for it.
I mean, I think about David. Somehow in his mind, he had convinced himself that whole Bathsheba thing was on the up and up, to the point that when, you know, Nathan's there telling him a parable, I mean, he can't even see what's going on here.
He can't even see himself in it.
No, he can't even see what's going on. And he's getting all hacked off. And he's like, man, find that guy that you're talking about. We're going to kill that dude. And it's like, dude, how are you so bent out of shape at this guy right now after what just happened? Maybe David was like, nope, love at first sight. That's right. You ever heard of that? Like, well, if it's love at first sight, then it can't be bad. So I'm going with it.
Yeah, I'm sure he was able to justify it in some way in his own mind. Love at first sight, or, you know, I'm king, and this is something to which I am entitled. And as far as the murder of Uriah, I suppose that was probably the easiest to excuse in his own mind, because people die in war. You know, it happens.
Yeah.
And just because, you know, it wasn't like he said to the general, I want you to put a knife in his back. Instead, he wants him to put him in the most dangerous situation possible in war. So could Uriah have lived in those circumstances? Well, I suppose he could have got away somehow. And so David's thinking to himself, well, you know, war is hell. People die, you know, just because somebody had to be in the front lines, right?
Dude. Okay. Uriah is one of David's, we're way off track here, but Uriah is one of David's mighty men, right?
Yeah.
which means that Uriah is awesome.
Yeah.
Right?
He's special forces.
Yeah. Like Uriah.
He's killed his thousands.
Yeah, dude. Dude. David knows that Uriah is such a badass that you're going to have to put him in the front and then pull everyone back. And like, and maybe he'll die if he doesn't. Yeah. If he doesn't kill the entire army he's fighting,
that's the only way it's gonna happen.
It's like put him up front, and then everyone leave because like he's gonna kill like who knows how many dudes before he goes down. But that's
William Wallace had nothing on Uriah. Braveheart. You cannot imagine the scene that this would have been.
Yeah, dude, I want the footnotes of that. It's like, I want and after Uriah killed 350 men, he went down, you know?
You know, all of this just makes me realize that David was even more foolish, you know? Look who he's messing with. He's, this is the mightiest warrior, and David still does what he does. Sinners are foolish people.
And you do have like sort of a dual sin here too, you know. I mean, so Jacob, obviously, this is like not what you. This is not loving your neighbor or your brother, to manipulate him out of his birthright. And then, of course, I suppose it is wrong of Esau to sell his birthright a little bit. I suppose his is more just. I mean, if you are going to die, like I mean, and he does say this. I mean, hey, I mean. It's not like he wants to do it. It's not his idea, right? Like, it's like, well, what good is it to me? Jacob, you bring up a good point. You're going to have it either way.
Yeah, he's in dire straits. People do things they regret later on when we're in dire straits. I mean, he brings up later, once Jacob actually steals the blessing from him, he brings up this episode, you know, he's deceived me twice now, Esau says. First he deceived me by taking the birthright, and now he's deceived me by taking the blessing. So both of these brothers do not come out of this unscathed. In fact, the book of Hebrews talks about Esau selling his birthright for a single meal and, you know, taking him to task for that. But at the same time, Jacob is, at least as I'm reading this story, if anybody comes out with more strikes against him, it's Jacob. It's not Esau.
I've heard pastors preach on this and them say, and it always bothered me, say like, and he wasn't really like literally like starving to death. I mean, you know, he's just really hungry. There's nothing in there that like implies that he wasn't actually scared that, for wherever they were and however far like they had to go to get home or whatever, that it seems like Esau did not believe he was going to make it. Maybe it's winter and there's not or something, and you can't, you know, who knows, but at least in the text itself there's nothing to imply that this is untrue, that if I don't eat something soon I'm not going to make it.
Yeah, there's nothing that seems to make this an exaggeration. At least in Esau's mind, that's where he was. He was on the point of death. And so if what good is a birthright if you're dead?
Yeah.
So I think this is, Jacob has been waiting for this to happen. He's been biding his time, waiting for just the right opportunity to be able to do something like this. And once it happens, he seizes the opportunity and he does it.
You know, this is all in the realm of speculation. I feel like there's a better chance, knowing what I know about Jacob. I don't think it's Esau is like two blocks from his house and just really loves lentil soup and was like, oh man, I really gotta get some of that. Dude, I'm starving to death. Give me some of that. I'll give you my birthright. That's insane. What's probably more likely is that, I don't know, Esau's gone hunting or whatever. He hasn't come back. Like the storm blows in or something. It's winter. I don't know. Whatever's going on. So Jacob, being the deceiver that he is, like packs up some stuff to make food. Man, he's been gone a long time. And like, this is my opportunity. I'm going to find him and I'm going to sucker him. Like, I'm not going to just save him for nothing. I'm going to, I'm going to save him for a fee.
Yeah. This was not a spur of the moment decision on the part of Jacob. This was done. This was premeditated.
Yeah. I think it's comforting to see that it draws both of them out as sinners, that they've both sinned here. I think that the comforting thing for us in that, especially somebody who may have come out of a holiness movement or who's been told, well, if you just do the right things, then you can keep from sinning. The fact of the matter is we don't live in a world where we can either be standing in the white or in the black. It's a gray world, and we are sinners. We are stained, and everything that we do is tainted by this stain of sin. We sin because we are sinners, you could say. But what it all comes down to is not are you keeping yourself from sinning by doing the right things and not doing the wrong things. This goes all the way back to First Commandment stuff where Jesus really draws us out. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Or Luther puts it this way, fear, love, and trust God above all things. So the First Commandment, you shall have no other gods, is basically telling us that in thought, word, and deed, you shall fear, love, and trust God, obey him in all things. And none of us do that. So this is a comforting thing to see that in every situation, even in this situation where he's literally dying, and the only thing that he can do to preserve his own life is to give up, to despise his birthright, to literally despise the thing that his life has earned him. Simply by being born. It's not something that he earned, but it's something that he deserves. That if he should lose it, it is as if he is dying. So he's literally hating his own life. This is comforting for us then, because we see it's not that this is now a permission to just go out and sin, but it gives us permission to turn to God in trust and in faith that he is the only holy and righteous one, and that he is the one that only by faith and trust in God are we made holy and righteous. Are we not seen as the sinners that we are, but are we seen then as righteous, just as Jacob is called righteous later throughout the scriptures?
That's a great point, and that's one of the reasons long ago I fell in love with the Old Testament, is because it illustrates the very things that you're talking about, by taking us into the nitty-gritty, the dirty lives of people like Jacob and Esau, or Abraham and Sarah, or David and Bathsheba. You know, this is the Old Testament strikes us as what you might say existentially true. I mean, we see this in our very existence. This is who we are. The things that Jacob and Esau struggled with, their fights, their jealousies, their deceptiveness, all of this is the same stuff that we experience in our own existence day to day. And the thing that you see over and over, however, is that despite the soiled resumes that these guys have, and these gals have as well, is that they still are loved by God. That despite, you know, over and over and over, that Jacob ends up being this trickster, that he nevertheless is loved by God and protected by God and forgiven by him, because ultimately Jacob is righteous, not righteous in and of himself, not righteous because he's such a good brother or a good son, but righteous because he has faith in the seed that was promised back to Adam and Eve, the messianic seed, the same one in whom Abraham believed, and his faith was reckoned to him as righteousness. So this promise of the seed and the righteousness that comes through him to Jacob and to Esau and to all of us, that is the means by which God accounts us as righteous and and continues to forgive us and to love us, even though our lives are no better than that of Jacob and Esau, because we're just like they are. We create false gods, among whom are the God of self, and engage in the same sorts of duplicity and backstabbing that they engage in. They were reckoned righteous by the same thing by which we are reckoned righteous, the messianic seed. And that's one of the great benefits of studying stories like this, is you see yourself in these stories. You see your own life. You see the grace of God in Christ in the lives of these people, despite all of the flaws that they constantly exhibit.
I just want to say one quick thing. That's great. Yeah. This is also encouragement to allow yourself to be vulnerable, not simply so that you can shock people with the fact that you are a sinner, that you have done terrible things, but to give people a mirror in your own life to look into. You can look at these folks in scripture and you can see yourself in Jacob. I can see myself in Jacob. I can see myself in Esau. I can see myself in David. I can see myself in Abraham and Isaac. And it's not generally the good things. I can see a little bit of myself in the bad things. That's what I'm talking about here. And so people become a little maybe uncomfortable with that, but it's not necessarily. Here's the thing I've learned. I do not become so uncomfortable around people who are honest with the fact that they are broken, that they are weak, that they stumble, that they sin, because of those things in them. I'm not uncomfortable to be around them because of them, but because it shows me a little picture into my own soul and that I am a mess. I see myself in them a little bit. But this is a great way, when you're witnessing to somebody or sharing your faith with somebody, to in a very gentle way, bring about the law, the proclamation of the law. And then you can turn right around and show them what a great Savior you have. And so I always encourage people, you know, let's be honest about this. I mean, none of us are holy in and of ourselves, or righteous in and of ourselves. These are gifts from God. And we desperately need them because of the mess that we've made of our own lives.
Yeah, there's definitely something about being able to look at these other guys and not feel alone, right? Where you're like, well, if Jacob can be declared righteous, then maybe there's hope for me, you know? And so, like, there is an encouragement there, and something that's comforting about looking at the lives of those in the Old Testament and saying, okay, and I think that's why it's there, you know. I mean, that's at least partially why it's there, is to show you that you're not the only sinner on the planet. So God had a bunch of stories about sinners written down so that you would know, actually, this is everyone. This is how you guys are, and I save people like that. If the Old Testament, or just the Bible in general, was just full of all the heroics. It was just full of giant slaying and martyrdom and all this kind of stuff. It would be rough, man. But instead, you get all these stories of, you know, you have David's sin, and you have Abraham's sin, and you have Peter's denial and all this stuff. And in a strange way, this is how God works things together for good. In a strange way, their failures are comforting to people who no doubt fail.
Yeah, that's amen to all of that. That's one of the beauties of the scriptures, is that it records the ugly truths of the lives of sinners, so that we can see ourselves in these stories. That our story is no different than the life of Abraham or whoever it might be. And just as they receive grace, so do we.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got about 8 or so minutes left here. Is there is there something that's going to happen after this that we can touch on a little bit, because we've seen it before?
Yeah, let's. Speaking of everything that we've just been talking about with regard to the mistakes and the sins of the patriarchs. Well, let's get to the next one, which is chapter 26. Chapter 26 is sort of the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree kind of chapter, because it's all about Isaac, or mainly about Isaac, and good things about him and not so good things about him. But over and over throughout this chapter, what God says to him, where he goes, what he does, his interactions with people, even people with the same name, are all just like what happened to his father Abraham. So they dig the same wells, they build altars, they deal with a guy named Abimelech, and as we're about to see here, they also lie about their wives. So in the few minutes that we have left, yeah, let's jump ahead. This is chapter 26. So it starts out with something we've heard before. There was a famine in the land. There was a famine in the land in the days of Abraham, and Abraham ended up in Egypt. And that's where everything happened between him and Sarah and Pharaoh, as we've talked about before. Now, this is a little bit different scenario, because God explicitly tells Isaac, when there's famine in the land, don't go down into Egypt. Maybe God realizes that Abraham and his descendants don't do so well when they go down into Egypt, especially when there's famine in the land. So God's like, no, we're not going there again. I know what happened last time. Your dad went into Egypt, and I had to end up rescuing Sarah after he had lied about her, and she was taken into the harem of Pharaoh. You know, what a mess that was, Isaac. We're not going to do that again. So stay where you're at. And then God goes on to just pour out all these promises. You know, I will be with you. I will bless you. I'm going to give you and your descendants all these lands. I've sworn to Abraham. I'm also making this promise to you. I'm going to give you all these descendants. He goes on and on about all these things that he's going to do for Isaac. And while these words are still ringing in the ears of Isaac, all these lavish divine promises of protection and grace and presence, the very next story we hear tells us that these things did not make much of an impact on Isaac's behavior. Because after God finishes speaking, it says Isaac lived in Gerar. And now verse 7. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, drumroll.
He probably said, yeah, that's my wife. Lucky man that I am.
Yes, you see that beautiful woman there? She is definitely my wife. No, that's actually not what Isaac said. Maybe he had heard too many stories from his father about what happened down in Egypt, and actually what happened more than once also with a former Abimelech. Isaac had heard what his father did, and as it turns out, he decided to follow suit, because when the men of the place asked about Rebekah, he said, Rebekah, Isaac's wife, he said, she is my sister. For he was afraid to say, my wife, thinking the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful.
To think that these, Abraham and Isaac and stuff, these Jewish dudes, right? They're like, tell you what, they're just godless down there in Egypt. They'll straight take your hot wife, so you best lie about it. And I have a feeling like people down in Egypt be like, I don't know what's with these sojourners, but they are some godless liars.
Yeah, I could see that happening. That would stand a reason, right?
Both parties are like, these people got no fear of God whatsoever.
Yeah, isn't that the way it goes? Everybody's a worse sinner than I am.
Yeah. I'm going to have to lie to defend myself against their wickedness.
notice that Isaac doesn't say, I'm going to lie to protect my wife.
No, neither does Abraham either.
Neither does Abraham. Yeah. Neither one of these guys seem to be that afraid of what's going to happen to their wives, but they sure are afraid of what's going to be happening to themselves. Yeah. The apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
Yeah. That, so, I mean, it's fun. It's funny how repetitive that is. You got to love it when the Bible just repeats sins over again, where you're kind of like, yeah, we get it. Like, this is something that happens, but it's there for a reason, you know. It's like, no. Like, this is what you will. I mean, it's there to show us that again and again with different people. Like, you will lie to save yourself, and you will put someone else in jeopardy to save yourself. When push comes to shove, like, you'll do it. And like, push hasn't even really come to shove. It's just like, he's like afraid of a reputation that he doesn't even, because everything that we know about like Abimelech or any of these guys, it doesn't sound like they were like in their response, like, oh, what, we've taken this guy's wife. It doesn't actually,
they're dismayed.
Yeah. It doesn't lend itself to the argument that like, oh no, these guys will straight kill you and take your wife. Like, they don't sound like those kind of dudes in their response.
No, they're the ones that come out sounding righteous. In fact, it's not Isaac and Abraham.
It's Isaac and the band covering Abraham's greatest hit, same song, third verse, but it's a different singer and he's a crooner. He likes to carry the song for a long time, as it says in the next verse there.
Yeah, no doubt, right?
He had been there a long time.
Like, yeah. I wonder if Abraham's like, listen, Isaac, I'm not saying you should ever do this.
But
let me tell you what worked out pretty well for me twice.
He's like, you know, you see all this money I have?
Yeah.
you know where the family's wealth came from? Yeah. Well, we're in Egypt, and this is what happened.
If there's ever a famine, I'm not saying you have to do this, but this is what I did. It worked out all right.
I guess Isaac was the good listener.
Yeah, he's a good learner. He's good learned learner. Well. Yeah, and then it says he stayed there a long time. So he like keeps this thing up for a while.
Yeah, this is a long time. This is a long time deception. Are we out of time? Or are we gonna have to cut this story short?
We are out of time. We have
no one's gonna know what happens next. I guess they just gonna have to wait.
Next week we're gonna find out what happens to Isaac and Rebecca. It'll be par for the course. But guys, you know what? We are 6 weeks away from the Christ Hold Fast Conference. And,
all right.
And it seems like if you haven't registered for that, you should probably get on that. You can go over to ChristHoldFast.org and get that taken care of. You can also get a hotel room reserved there if you go to that page and scroll down and click on the little hotel icon. We've got some deals carved out with the hotels down there. So you can get a good deal on a room. And you can come hang out with me and Chad and Brandon and a whole bunch of other people. All the information's there, so go check that out. Thank you guys for listening again, and we'll see you next week.